Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of The Collective Podcast. I'm your host, Ash Thorpe, and this week we're joined by the creators of the game The Last Night, Tim Soray and Danny Waitson. They join us on this episode to share some insight into their game, and we discuss everything from politics to their view on society and possible future outcomes dealing with art and being a human. I had an amazing time meeting both Tim and Danny, and I'm really excited to share this one with you all. So here we go, everyone. Episode 159. Let's roll. Yeah, so first off, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you guys are busy and you guys have got a lot of stuff going on, I imagine, but you guys were really quick to respond and I really appreciate that. And that's, again, as I was mentioning earlier, it's one of my favorite things about the internet now and just the speed of connection. I saw the trailer that you guys released and I was like, whoa, this is so awesome. And I sent to Andrew and I said, please, can we figure out a way of getting you guys on the show, because I'm just very curious about what it is that you guys are doing and the progress and all that stuff. And you're kind enough to share your time, and I appreciate it from both of you guys. So thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, Ash. Pleasure. Yeah, thanks for inviting us. We were both fans, but independently. I didn't actually know. I don't think Tim knew that. Like, I knew about you. I guessed he would, but yeah, I've been following you on Instagram for ages now. So when the invite came through, it was, super flattering, and it made sense, you know, that you and Tim kind of knew each other and stuff. So, was very cool.
Yeah, I love it. It's a small world, and I love when things kind of align and you have the ability to like reach out and be connected so quickly. And that's something that I'm hoping for anybody that's listening to. It's like, you know, if you're interested in something that somebody's doing, you should just go and reach out to them. You know, chances are that they might react or respond back, you know, and then you can create dialogue.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's basically not to hopefully not to preempt one of your questions, but that's basically how I got involved with you, isn't it, Tim? So you and your brother Adrian made the game jam, the Cyberpunk game jam, back in 2014, and basically I just kind of hustled and emailed you, and Tim's first response to me was like, "Oh, thanks. It's always nice to hear from fans." And I was like, "No. I don't want to be a fan."
That's awesome. Yeah, that is a question I was going to ask too. Is your origin story? So yeah, please explain to me, because I'm curious to see how you all, I mean, obviously Tim and your brother Adrian, you guys are brothers, so that's an obvious, but how do you guys all kind of align?
Sure. You know, before going into game development, I was a motion designer, so that's how I know you and your work, of course. And I was not really the Cinema 4D kind of motion designer. You know, I was more like the After Effects guys, and the guy, you know, who used to fake 2D to fake 3D, you know, with a lot of 2D trickery. Yeah. And I guess you can see how it translated to game design, basically, because the whole look of the game comes from actually, you know, this skill set that I try to translate to this new industry, basically. Yeah. So that was a fascinating transition, and I have to thank also Element 3D, you know, the plugin from Andrew Kramer for After Effects. That was for me, you know, that was my first contact with real time 3D, basically, you know, and it was so liberating to be free from render times, basically.
Yeah. Andrew Kramer is pretty awesome. We had him on the show too, and it's the amount of impact that he's had on the community as a whole is just massive. Yeah. You know, so it's super cool, and it's awesome to hear that, because I like that. We'll get into that too in a little bit later, but continue what you're saying.
So so what happened is that I wanted to transition from making advertisements, you know, and to create world of my own, basically. And I had this idea of making games since a long, long time. Especially I wanted to bring back cinematic platformers. So in case you don't know exactly what it is, you know, a cinematic platformer is, you know, it's not really about jumping around on platforms. It's more reminiscent, you know, of old classics like Another World, Prince of Persia, Flashback, Oddworld's Abe's Odyssey. You know, these kind of old games, you know, these kind of experiences, more, you know, narrative experiences. It's more story driven, and it's a genre that, you know, is a very Very rare, actually. Like, we only have a few games recently that, you know, could fit that. We have Little Nightmares, we have Inside, and Limbo before, you know. But oh yeah, overall, it's very tame. So I wanted to, you know, take my own, take my chance, basically, and try to see what I could do in that genre and bringing a whole new style to it, yeah.
Yeah, it's a genre that I think people that are into it are incredibly passionate about.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We are as creators, and we found that about the fans, and then we as fans of games like Limbo, you know, Playdead, like Inside. But yeah, it's actually like Tim, like you say, it's not compared to so many genres, that many studios like taking a crack at it.
Mm.
So
I would say like cyberpunk, actually, even cyberpunk, yeah. There is not, you know, 10 cyberpunk movie per year. It's quite rare, actually.
Yeah.
So you Ash, you had the chance to work on Ghost in the Shell, like the remake.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, like before that revival, you know, before like these last 2 years, I mean, cyberpunk was almost disappearing from the industry, basically. Like, we didn't see a good cyberpunk movie in years, basically.
Yeah.
Now we have Blade Runner 2, Ghost in the Shell, you know, it's like coming back slowly because it becomes relevant again, I feel.
Yeah.
It's our current world, but yeah.
You guys excited for the new Blade Runner?
It's an interesting question. Yeah. Of course, because the team on it is incredible, right?
Like, I've heard it's really good. I've heard it's really good.
Yeah.
People have seen it already, so they say it's great.
Yeah. I have no doubt, you know, it's going to be a good movie. The thing is, I am so in love, you know, with the patine of Blade Runner, like the gritty, cluttered look of it.
Yeah.
And I feel we are kind of, you know, a bit moving away from that art direction and cinematography. I feel we are more going for like the, you know, Nicolas Winding Refn, super clean,
stylized,
theatrical style, you know, with like, you know, cut lighting and everything. It looks gorgeous, sure,
but it's not as overwhelming, I think, visually, as spectacle as Ridley's, that's for sure. Yeah, not to say anything, taking anything away from those guys, because I mean Roger Deakins is a master in his own right, but I think it's a different style. I agree, something I noticed as well. But change is inevitable, and that's something that's good. You want something new to happen, but at the same time, it's almost like you want to an extended version of the first film in a different, if we could, but I mean, as fans of it, it's really difficult, right, to discern these different things, you know, so.
Yeah, we're not the best customers. I mean, we are the worst, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
We are. Yeah, we are. You know, like, especially now that you're, you know, obviously you're a content creator yourself. So, and you know the cycle of it because you just kind of release some stuff. And then we'll talk about that, releasing things and then the social reaction to people and using the internet and all that kind of stuff is quite interesting. But yeah, that's cool. I'm excited. I'm just curious. Sometimes I'm worried and I'm like, Denny is pretty awesome director. And I think he's one of the few that can pull something off as big as this. So, and I've heard really great things.
Yeah. We all hope for the best, obviously.
Yes,
and it's only natural that, you know, people that are so invested in the genre, obviously are always going to be the most passionately hopeful and the hardest to please.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly.
You know, we'll soon see. But, you know, aside from us, it's obviously brilliant that, you know, hopefully it will kind of introduce or reintroduce the genre to, you know, all the people that were kind of just a little bit too young to really be taken in by the original.
Yeah.
And then hopefully they'll discover the original, and seeing it in that order will probably be really, really interesting.
Yeah.
So obviously it's only a good thing in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
And you know, it's obviously not hurting our case.
Yeah, I was gonna say
Survival's not a bad thing for our game at all. So
definitely. if it's really bad, then it will be, but at the same time it's fine because it's awareness anyways.
It's win-win. No, it's win for us. If it's terrible, then people will be looking, you know, for the savior.
That's true. That's a good point. That's a good point to have too, you know? So, I was going to ask you too, and it's funny that we're already, you know, like 5 minutes or so into the conversation, or 8 minutes into the conversation, we're already talking about cyberpunk, which is perfect. I wanted to kind of get a definition from you guys as to what cyberpunk is to you, individually, and perhaps the you know, what is the distilled thing? Because I think that's another thing that kind of makes it abstract. You know, some people are like, oh, it's Neuromancer. And then some people are like, no, it's Blade Runner. And then some people are like, you know, no, it's actually this definition, you know. So and so I think, and there's different scales to it. There's some people are like, oh, it's Ghost in the Shell. And it's like, okay, well, what is it exactly to you guys?
Do you want to start?
Okay, I can start because I think my definition is really, really simple, actually. So I studied film growing up from school and uni, and I became obsessed with film noir. And through that, you know, actually picked up all the books. And
which films? I'm just so like Citizen Kane stuff or?
Like more like the kind of the classic Bogart stuff, really. Okay. You know, Double Indemnity, Postman Only Rings Twice, The Big Sleep, and then with the novels, obviously Dashiell Hammett, the kind of just the pulpier the better, really. And I was thinking about this the other day, kind of going back to The Big Sleep, and it doesn't really make any sense. Like as a story, but the kind of overall tone of it, just the feeling and the tone in the characters are kind of what I love. And for me, like cyberpunk isn't about having a strict definition or, you know, a strict canon of films or books. Like what I've always been obsessed with cyberpunk is just film noir, but with many more possibilities because of, you know, what future and the technology allows. So one of my favorite, you know, inverted commas, cyberpunk novels is Altered Carbon, which is really, really very genre noir, just set in the future with one or two futuristic ideas. So, you know, I don't mean to be woolly and wishy-washy, but for me, it's just kind of that.
That's what I'm saying. It, for the most part, it's a big response. It's not like it's this, you know. Some people are very sharp about it. Some people are. It's a bit of this. It's a patina of that, and a little mix of this movie, and it's a part of this book, and it's a part of this, and that's what I find really interesting about the genre itself, because it's very vast, really, you know. All genres are like that, you know. Sometimes you talk about what's a Western. Okay, well, it's a cowboy and some sort of like native person, and then there's like a damsel in distress or something, and then you have a gun show, basically, you know.
Well, a Western. It's funny that actually you should bring up Westerns, because I think it's a close cousin in a way to cyberpunk, but it's like it was kind of separated at birth. So for me, like a Western is very, very much about the, you know, the masculine ideal of the kind of lone gunslinger. Occasionally the group of gunslingers, like seven, what's it really called? You know, based on Seven Samurai, Magnificent Seven. And that kind of ideal of the kind of masculine individual.
Yeah.
And one of the things I love most about cyberpunk is how it actually subverts that, you know, and how the initially masculine individual often becomes incredibly helpless and kind of disassociated and confused.
Like Blade Runner, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because he's a replicant himself, and we'll get into that later too, probably. So, but that's okay. That's awesome. And it's good to know kind of where your head's at. It's funny you mentioned Altered Carbon. I have that on my shelf. I'm looking at it right now. Tim, how about you? What is cyberpunk to you? What got you interested in this genre?
I'm a complete heretic to cyberpunk. What I'm gonna say is not going to please a lot of people, but basically, I think cyberpunk for me is more about a mood and a state and like a reflection of modern life. Basically, it's like an exaggeration of today's world, and you know, trying to replicate the feeling of urban life. Basically, so for me, even a movie like Lost in Translation, it's not properly cyberpunk, but it evokes the same feeling I can have in front of Blade Runner, for instance. For me, it evokes, you know, this kind of paradoxical solitude you have in big cities, where you see millions of people by your window and you still feel completely alone. And, you know, there is this kind of really weird oxymoron in cyberpunk sometimes, you know, where you are in such crowded places and at the same time, you have no friends, you know, you have nobody, you're just, you know, you feel like this insignificant and, you know, yeah, like a cog in the machine. And so for me, that's quite interesting. So the thing is, you know, there is a distinction now between what we call cyberpunk and post-cyberpunk. I don't want to dive too much into details, but one of the main differences is that in classical cyberpunk, characters are usually kind of free agents. You know, that's the link with Western for me.
Yeah,
it's like free world, open world. Yeah.
Yeah, they can go around and, you know, do whatever they want and shoot a lot of people, and that's fine. I feel for me, what I like about post-cyberpunk is usually the main character is not adrift, but is like anchored into society. And that's where I feel there is something interesting. You know, also for me, the recipe is kind of a bit old for me in a certain way. So not the visual style, but I mean, you know, we live already in a cyberpunk world. I mean, we have whistleblowers that exposed massive surveillance state, right? We have multinational corporation who are evading taxes. We have drones and machine learning and augmentations. All of that is coming. It's already there. It's our world, right? So in a certain way, I feel cyberpunk is not that much about the future anymore. It's about today. Like we live in this, you know, multicultural Los Angeles, and there is no, for me, we need to refresh a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. We caught up with cyberpunk.
Yeah. Caught up.
So that's the weirdest thing. Like,
so that's why, you know, if it's a genre about the future and anticipation, it should be constantly self reassessing itself, always, you know, self questioning and being redefined, basically.
Yeah.
So I don't get why some people are, you know, very, very thorough about following a certain style of cyberpunk. You know, like cyberpunk has to be against that or that. And for me, it's a constraint that, you know, I disagree with. Like, cyberpunk can be anything, you know, as long as it's talking about these themes, you know.
Yeah. I mean, an interesting counterpoint to that is, like, if you think of, at least in like literary genre terms, like fantasy, right, is always looking back.
Yeah.
And so
it's a very conservative genre.
Conservative genre. Yeah. And I mean, I love fantasy. Like, I absolutely.
Good fantasy is awesome. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, and, you know, look at, in video game terms, I mean, it's still one of the biggest selling genres. Look at The Witcher, look at Skyrim. You know, people always have a hunger for that kind of, that fantasy setting.
Yeah.
But of course, like, it's only backward looking. You can't have future fantasy.
Yeah.
So, you know, by contrast, something like cyberpunk, even though, you know, the when it was kind of first being used as a term, it was, you know, very much a reaction to kind of basically like trends in the 80s and 20 minutes into the future paranoia. Just like sci-fi, it's one of the few genres we have that, as you just said, Tim, can constantly and should constantly reevaluate itself.
Yeah.
But whereas sci-fi, kind of traditional sci-fi, is often millions of years in the future.
Mm.
Cyberpunk is always that, like, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
20 minutes into the future. And that's, I think, why it's one of the, something that people feel the most passionate about.
Yeah, because it's
very, very relatable.
Exactly. Relatable is a world. Yeah. For me, it's, it's like taking the current world and, you know, toying with it, exaggerating some aspect of it, and trying to extract something of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And funny, actually, I never thought about Lost in Translation as like a proto cyberpunk film.
It's a great film.
But also, if you look at purely the link between Scarlett Johansson, actually, and her character.
Funny, right?
And then her.
It's very similar.
Yeah, actually,
it's really similar.
There is this one shot where she's in her bedroom, you know, and she sees the city.
Yeah, looking in her pants.
Yeah, yeah.
Looking out the window.
Yeah, and you have kind of the same shot in Ghost in the Shell where she's, like, you know, looking at her circle glass window. Yeah. So, and it's an interesting parallel, you know, between how she evolved.
And also, you know, the whole, like, Suntory whiskey thing.
Yeah.
That kind of, like, you know, Japlish, that's become like a massive staple of cyberpunk.
Yeah.
That kind of, that weird, like, it's nonsensical corporate endorsement.
It has this very, as you said, relatable, right? It's like, yeah, it's like the same word, but slightly different, slightly otherworldly. And Lost in Translation had that quality because as an Occidental, you know, you see that and you feel it's not exactly our world.
Yeah.
Sure, they use red lights and cars and everything like us, but it's not exactly the same. Mm. And cyberpunk for me is a bit that, you know, everything has to be slightly different into that world. So, yeah.
Oh, I love it. This is great. I was going to ask you if you guys have encountered the film Ex Machina or Ex Machina.
Course, yeah.
And I think the director, from what I read from him, is he wrote. Did he write 28 Weeks Later, 28 Days Later? I remember. Yeah, he
28 Days Later, and also Enslaved: Odyssey to the West.
I haven't seen that. Is that a film? What is that?
No, a game.
Oh, it's so a game, huh? He wrote a game.
Yeah, that's a game that he wrote. And
what's it called?
Enslaved: Odyssey to the West. So it's basically a post-apocalyptic cyberpunk riff on Journey to the East or Journey to the West, even. You know, the kind of Chinese folktale.
Yeah. Interesting.
Basically post-apocalyptic with androids. Mm. And the studio is Ninja Theory. And it was quite a kind of overlooked game, I think. But it had Nitin Sawhney did the soundtrack. Andy Serkis did all the mocap. It was like an incredible, like, traditional Hollywood film cast, basically, collaborating on this game. And it was absolutely brilliantly written.
I think that's where his stuff really shines. I think a lot of the problems with films in general is the foundation where the story is lacking, because the story is really hard to come up with really great stories, I think, because it takes a certain type of mind and a certain type of dedicated person to create worlds that have like really tight stories, you know? And I think with Ex Machina, am I saying it right or pronouncing it right? Because I think Machina, I don't know. So, but with him, what he was saying when you're talking about, you know, the 20 minutes of the future, that was literally his take on his premise of his story. Is like, okay, this is like, you know, 10 days away, basically. The whole thing is like, what if this was 10 days away? There's just like, you know, this billionaire programmers, like he's out in the wilderness making AI, basically. What happens there? Spoiler alert, too, for those of you who watched it. And if you haven't watched it by now, shame on you. So, yeah.
Yeah.
You deserve a spoiler alert, sure, you. Yeah. but, I mean, that's another kind of interesting thing. And then another thing to talk about in a genre that is kind of, we're catching up with, which is ironic too, right? Which is kind of funny. And then there's films that are, I would consider, like intellectual sci-fis, like Her, for example, the same kind of thing. But
oh, I love Her.
Yeah, but that's kind of touching that Lost in Translation thing, you know? And then that's kind of going in line with what Charlie's been doing with Black Mirror. It's another show I talk about a lot in the episodes too, which I think is quite interesting. Yeah. So, but I think they're all kind of tied together in their own respects, because they're all kind of, they have those solid similar through lines. And it's funny you introduce Westerns, because Sergio Leone films are really heavily based on like all the old Japanese classics and stuff as well. And I think same with like George Lucas is really inspired by them. And it's funny to see where these things are going, you know, and the trends of these things. Mm-hmm. As you guys look at this whole thing, do you guys take a step back and look at like, okay, games are here, films are over here. Do you meld them together? And then where do you think all this is going? Being content creators yourself, where do you think films and games are going to be in 10, 20 years from now?
Oh, it's an interesting question. The thing is, it's going to evolve. I mean, there are a lot of discussion to have around this topic, because, of course, the delivery of a movie and a game might change soon. You know, like maybe our kids, you know, when we show them that we spend all our life on these rectangles, you know, that we call screens. Maybe in the future it will look weird, you know, that we spend all our time on 2D interfaces.
Yeah.
You know, and we had to move windows around and, you know, multitask on these constrained interfaces. I think in the future it might change. So if the delivery change, of course, you know, like the medium is a message, right? So you don't deliver a movie in the same way, you know, that you would in VR, for instance. And the same for a game, right? You don't make a mobile game the same way you make a console game, like a narrative experience. So I don't know. I feel, you know, the only thing that could bring video game closer to movies maybe is like the evolution of graphics basically is almost catching up. Like I would say, you know, in 10 years we're going to be very, very close to movies.
Yeah.
And even right now it's looking scarily close sometimes, especially if you look at top-notch studios like Naughty Dog.
Yeah.
You know, they're making state-of-the-art facial animations and we think it's mind-blowing.
It's past the uncanny valley. We're not obviously it's not at parity, but I think it's gone past that gap.
Yeah. It's still really hard to tell, but it's still there, but it's slowly getting there. There's a really interesting podcast. I think it's from I can't remember I'll come up with it in just a minute, but they did a whole episode on Uncanny Valley, which I thought was really interesting. Let me see if I can find it. It's on my podcast, but it was really interesting because they were talking about like how like sensitive we are. It's called Stuff to Blow Your Mind, Uncanny Valley. This is the episode. You should check that out. But they talked about it in video games and stuff, and in films and movies and all this stuff. And they were saying like how finite we are with these things. If it looks too much like a human, we discern it. If it looks too fake, not like a human, we don't like it. There's just like this fine little gap, you know, where we allow it to exist within like, you know, comfort, I guess, you know, of us and our observation. And I think that is so difficult. And talking about the fidelity and bringing that resolution. But I think it's what you touched on too is so funny. And I talk about this all the time is, we're the generation that grew up with physical things. And I think the generations moving forward are going to start living and existing in an artificial, you know, they put the goggles on, they put the whatever it is, like they plug into something that it bends the physical realm, you know? And it's so funny because we're so stuck to the window. And that brings me to the next thing I want to talk about is being stuck to that window. Your game has a style that merges multiple things, but you are living within those constraints of like using 2D kind of like pixel art, but you're merging it with like what looks like projected kind of 3D kind of some of it looks projected, some of it doesn't. I don't know, but what are your thoughts on that? I mean, that's a style design, right? That's a decision, right? To do this melded style, right?
Yeah. Of course, it's an aesthetics, but more than that, it's also in hindsight, when I see what we did with the story, and especially how we decided to make our main character unable to enjoy this gamified world, you know, this augmented world that everybody's living in. In a certain way, you know, the fact that the game is between 2D and 3D, it kind of represents what the character is living. Also, you know, it's like in this future, but he cannot live. The augmented layer that everybody's living in a certain way, you know, is like on the fence between the old world and the new world, you know, is like not really, is like between everything. So even the visuals are actually relevant in a certain way.
I mean, I think this is what's, and I say this as both a fan, you know, because I was a fan of the game before I was involved in the game. Now I'm involved in a game, so I don't want it to sound egotistical, but I think this is what's so genius about the visual style. Is it's such a weird contrast. You almost feel like it shouldn't work, but it does. And coming back to what you were just saying, Ash, about the uncanny valley and how sensitive we are to things, it's like what's always interested me. I was thinking about this when I was watching Kingsglaive, you know, the most recent Final Fantasy film. Have you seen it, Ash?
No, I haven't. What's it
called? Have you seen it, Tim?
Yeah, it's extremely realistic.
Kingsglaive, Final Fantasy Kingsglaive. It's like the prequel film to the new Final Fantasy 15.
Okay.
And it's like the mocap and the graphics are just absolutely incredible. It's genuinely really, really hard to tell at times whether it's real or not. And
I'll be the decider of that. And I'm joking. Go ahead.
It's not a
I'm
bad
watching
film.
Some of it right now.
It's complete bobbins, you know, the plot's ridiculous, but
mostly it usually it is.
It has some cool characters. This is worth a watch. It's crazy how realistic it is. And then looking back at some of the comments we had for the trailer on YouTube and things where people said, you know, like this expresses so much. I get such a feeling.
On our trailer, you mean? Yeah.
In our trailer, So on the one hand, we've got technology that can really almost fool the incredibly sophisticated human eye, but then we're still able to portray like a real depth of emotion. I mean, how many pixels does Charlie have?
Yeah. You're touching on what like Wally is like, you know, like
we, yeah, you know. 200 or 300 pixels max to our main character, you know, a few colors.
Yeah.
And it's like the human brain's crazy like that. Tim and our animators are able to express exactly the same emotions almost as billion pixel Final Fantasy state-of-the-art CGI. And
yeah, it's because instead of, you know, using facial expressions, we try to express everything through a body language, basically. So, you know, if a character is very stressed, you're not going to see, you know, you're not going to see him sweating because it's a pixel art game, right? But what you're going to see is, you know, the leg shaking under the table. And you're going to see, you know, his body language basically betraying him to a point where, you know, you can use that to your advantage. So, yeah, for us, it's, you know, yeah, we try to replace all the subtlety, you know, by basically, yeah, body language.
That's awesome.
But then the lighting you create and the depth of field and stuff with your style, like, gives that kind of, you know, almost at the same time tricks your eye and your brain into making it feel realistic, because like the lighting is realistic, so it
we use state of the art reflections and volumetric lighting, shadows and all kind of, you know, complex techniques, and especially a lot of post process also to make that work. And the thing is, yeah, you know, even when I was a kid, I remember one of my main inspiration is Flashback, and in the game the face is not drawn, it's just a blob of flesh color, basically. But my brain was like imagining his face, basically, you know, like you feel the details, a bit like literature. That's what I like about pixel art for me. It's like pixel art, if you don't give everything, the brain, you know, just naturally synthesize what's happening between the, you know, it interpolates what's happening between the pixels. It's crazy. And that's what I like, you know, it gives a bit of leeway for imagination, which sometimes we're lacking with, you know, very high fidelity 3D games. And that's what I like also. So in the same way, also, the fact that the game is between pixel art, you know, like, which is old style assets, and this new state of the art compositing, it's always the same stuff, right? It's like you have this thing that you know, and at the same time, I'm putting this kind of weird twist on it. So, you know, it's like yes, it's relatable, I know that, but it's completely new at the same time, and it feels a bit otherworldly, and I want to experiment that, which is also the point of Cyberpunk for me, as I said. So, yeah.
Very ethereal. It's very ethereal feeling. I was going to say this is a perfect example. What I'm getting at here is, and to prove your case from my standpoint too, is yes, when I look at yours, let's talk about styles, the difference between, say, like the Final Fantasy, and I don't want us to like hone in on that. So if you're a Final Fantasy fan, don't get butt hurt by our opinions. But like the thing is, I think what you're getting at is you're absolutely right. And I think what is happening in the viewer exchange is that with pixel art and this stuff that we, you know, with this kind of style, is we are, as a viewer, we're completing the painting. And you had mentioned that you like film noir, for example. When you watch film noir, really good film noir, really well photographed film noir, you're basically finishing it. It's like a great Rembrandt painting. You know, you're experiencing his emotions by the darks of his palette, you know, and so you're kind of finishing it in your head. And so it takes a certain type of viewer that likes that. Some viewers like to just be spoon-fed the completely like fully lit scene with all the pixels bright and bright, and that's great.
Yeah.
Some people like to finish it themselves, and I think that exchange is really key, and it's very important. I think that's something is very true. And I think it resonates with the right type of people. And I think that's the key. And you're right about people being stimulated by the same kind of dopamine drops when they would watch your video or maybe something else. I think it's activating the same kind of triggers. But I think that the key with your style, which I was hoping we were going to get into, which you guys naturally did, which is awesome, is creating that dialogue with allowing the abstraction to be then created and finished by the viewer, because that's when you really create something dynamic and great. I think that's when you make things classic, I think, because that's when you become part of the experience itself. And I think that's the key to it myself. And I think there's a lot to be said, and I hope for people that are content creators out there and thinking about it, it's like sometimes what you don't show is more powerful than what you do show, you know. I think that's really key, you know. So it's very cool.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. Thank you very much for saying so. I mean, it's a classic piece of wisdom, right? Like to read between the lines, and in writing, the age old saying is, you know, in describing a character, you should start the description on the page and let it finish in the reader's mind. I don't know what they say in the art world.
That's great.
Yeah, it's perfect. Not an artist, but
Yeah, in a way, you know, even a book is interactive. Like a book, you know, you can give every adjective yourself, yeah. Or you can just, you know, give pieces here and here and here and let the character, you know, let the reader, sorry,
yeah.
You know, yeah, being engrossed by the art and
exactly.
basically finishing, as you said, everything in his mind.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so it all comes back to interactivity, right? You asked about evolution of cinema and video games.
Yeah.
And that's something interesting because a game takes place in a future where creativity is waning, is like disappearing, you know, like it's a world where you can ask Netflix to come up with new episodes of Breaking Bad on the fly and it yeah. generates it, you know, endlessly if you want. Like if you're a big fan, no problem. You can even cancel the death of a character you cherish. You can, you know, it can generate it on the fly for you. It can hallucinate the picture and come up with a scenario because AI in the future, you know, they will have read and digested millions of stories and millions of screenplays and games and everything. While us, you know, creators in our life, like we only live 800 months, you know, we have a very short time span to ingurgitate stuff. So yeah, AI are going to be able to eat so much more and probably be more creative than us, which is kind of scary in a certain way.
Yeah. So we're quite simple creatures too. You know, if you break down like Joseph Campbell did like the whole, the hero's journey or something like that, where he breaks down the mythical story creations and how they're all kind of tied and they're similar and they're all kind of together.
Yeah, exactly. Because stories are born from language. I mean, that's not true. Language was born from stories.
Yeah.
Yes.
I can say,
you know, which had an evolutionary basis and we're all evolutionary animals and AI is arguably not evolutionary, you know, because it doesn't have the same biology as we do. So,
well, it evolves, I mean, though, doesn't it? I mean, I guess it will evolve in a rapid rate, I guess. But I mean, yeah, we're getting into weird theory, obviously. But yeah,
but it will have a different. I mean, I guess we could still kind of say
that AI will
have biological imperative, but it will be a different one to what we have.
Yeah.
So, you know, whatever imagined or realistic AI will have in the future, it will just have such a different agenda for what we have that it will be coming up with such different things. And I mean, and that's exciting and or terrifying depending on
who you are and what you are.
So that's the thing about, for me, evolution of movies and games. Yeah, it's I think movies are going to start to be interactive at some point.
Yeah.
I mean, if we go very far into that hypothetical future, yeah, movies might start to be interactive in a way that, you know, you can kind of branch, you know, your own story into that, you know, like if you don't like this Game of Thrones character's dying, you can change it and, you know, ask something else or ask to spend more time in this particular city if you want, you know, or ask to develop more that arc. And I guess there will be some level of interactivity coming to movies in a certain way. On the other way, I don't feel that games are going to lose interactivity. I don't feel that games are going close, you know, to I don't feel that games are going to get closer to cinema. And the reason is, you know,
do they even need to become closer to cinema too? That's another question I was going to ask too. It's like
No. I mean, it's great that, you know, we have games like Walking Dead from Telltale or Heavy Rain or you know, these games are neat. I mean, I love them.
Yeah.
But still, I feel that, you know, until now we had limited input into games, just buttons and joysticks.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we go very, very far into the future, we can guess that we might have real 3D input. You know, it's already starting with motion controls, you know, like very, you know, very intricate one-one, you know, motion controls in which you can start to manipulate objects and manipulate reality. You know, like you can make a game right now, you know, you can't make a game where you can hug people, for instance. Right, like it's easy to make a game where you can slash your sword at someone, but a game where, you know, you just pat someone in the back, you know, manually, like, you know, you act actually as an actor, you know, you're like someone in this world, you know, like you have to
empathy is the machine or something, huh?
So for that you need a more complex input than just buttons. Basically, you need something more. You need to be able to touch, you know, you need to be able to see. So I think games are just have in its infancy right now. Like you know, joypads, we're going to show that to our kids and they will love.
Yeah.
And you know, our AI that we have right now in games, they're just a collection of scripts, you know, they're just algorithm and they're really simplistic. And, you know, our kids, when they will play with a character, it will be their best friend, you know, it will be like a character that lives an incredible story with like someone that is, you know, properly generated in the game. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's someone who, yeah, it's crazy.
Does it scare
Does
it scare you?
Like, what, sorry?
Does that thought scare you? Because that's kind of a, for most people, they're like, you know, that's a very scary thought to think about being replaced and our kids, you know, best friends being these artificial AIs and stuff. But I'm curious to see what, does that, like, as a fundamental and moral kind of dilemma, I guess, is that kind of something that scares you?
No. I mean, you know, the game is not a dystopia. And I think all of that doesn't have to be dystopic for me. Like, yeah. I'm kind of a weirdo, so I kind of like that future. but yeah, there is always two sides to the coin, right? Exactly. Like, if you look at Pokemon Go, it was a fascinating phenomenon, right?
Yeah, it was interesting. But, psychological
but
thing.
But it's certainly interesting to think that some people needed that game to go again explore their city.
Yeah. And they needed that weird gamified excuse to do what
you should be doing, actually.
Yeah, what just, should, inverted commas. I mean, it's like
just going up with neighbors outside and just, you know, having fun and sharing time and discussing. Yeah, that would be. So
I think, you know, it's a lot of people are scared of change.
Yeah, of course. And well, because change in our history has been bad, you know.
Yeah.
But it comes from a deep rooted part of our evolution, I think, is why. So,
of course, and I think in a way we would all be stupid not to be scared of change.
Yeah.
But I don't think scared of something is reason not to do it. Right.
Sure. Yeah.
It's like we should always, you know, everything that we're doing individually, but also as a society, we should be a little bit scared of and keep an eye on it. I mean, this is why people like Bill Gates and Elon Musk are putting up billions to research, you know, fail-safes
for
AI. It's not because they think it will happen or they don't want it to happen, because obviously these are also the people that are pushing the most boundaries for humanity as
they
a whole.
They know it's happening. That's what the thing is, yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And they're sensible enough to go.
The smoke is already in the air. So, yeah.
Yeah. The smoke is in the air. Yeah. And the fire could be the fire of discovery or it could be the fire of destruction. And you would be, again, it all comes down to evolution. Like our ancestors that were most scared of being eaten by a tiger, you know, yes, they might have looked like an idiot a few times for being scared of like the wind in the trees and running away and picking up a stick.
Yeah.
But they're also the ones that survived because...
But that's where the balance work in evolution, right? It's like, if you think about it, maybe if you're risk averse, sure, you survive more often from tigers.
Yeah.
But maybe at the same time, if someone tells you, you know, winter is coming.
And you yes, Game of Thrones. Yeah.
Because it's scary to go outside.
Exactly. Yeah.
Then you die with your whole family. So, you know, there is a fine balance between the amount of people that want to perpetuate the system and the amount of people that want to change and innovate.
Yeah.
I feel there is a natural balance. And that's why not everybody is like that, right? No. It's like a small fringe where maybe 10% of people really try, you know, to imagine the future. And everybody thinks we're weirdos, but yeah.
I think it's good, though. That's why we're artists and creatives. I mean, we're there to try and manifest and ask the what ifs and use our gift of vision, future vision, I guess, if that's what you'd call it, open up these concepts and conversations, because it's important and interesting to have. So,
of course. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's sad when I think people get too scared of talking about the future to enjoy it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm Jewish. I'm neurotic. Have I lain awake at night worrying about the cyborg apocalypse? Of course I have, once or twice. But on the other hand, you know, I'm not going to let that stop me from enjoying, you know, some of the hypotheticals as well.
Sure.
So, it's a huge joy we have, the imagination.
For me, that's where her, for me, opened my eyes. You know, her, for me, was a transition from the usual Skynet conception we have of AI,
yes,
right? Like AI is this scary thing, you know, like singularity is going to destroy us.
Yeah.
But Her was a movie about singularity, actually.
Yes, it was. Yeah, yeah. And it was mostly like she was a coach of ushering him along out of his innate bad human issues, and he developed through her ushering him along by being almost like a sensei mentor, kind of like a Mr. Miyagi, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. She's the hot Mr. Miyagi.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah. Scarlett Johansson's clearly obsessed with cyberpunk.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah.
I met her. She's really nice, man. She was really cool. And I really enjoyed, it was a really weird film, but I really enjoyed it because it just how odd it was. But Under the Skin was really interesting. I talked briefly about that. Yeah, and it's very interesting. And I think that had a lot of interesting themes and subjects and ideas, and the way it was shot and the way it was conceived is really interesting. And I spoke with her briefly about that when we were on set, and just, she was really nice, so super cool. But I think it's possibly her, but she has a career trajectory, you know, and her producers and people that run her help with her career and all that stuff. They're like. Because before Ghost in the Shell, I think she did a film called Lucy or something like that. I never watched it, but it was very similar kind of thing, where it was like a super badass chick, you know, doing head kicks and like Matrix moves and stuff. And I think the key, what I was going to talk about with cyberpunk is, it's almost like it can be a skin for any story. If you can use those ingredients, but the key here is it's about the story. And that's one thing I wanted to get into next, because I guess I didn't see all the chatter about it, but people talking shit to you guys about like, it better be a good story. Is that true or no?
Let's make this very, very simple. People read into things too much when they're very passionate about something.
Sure.
They extrapolate.
So
the thing is, you know, it's easy. Like when you try to make anticipation work, you don't try to warn about how things are going to be. You try to warn about how things could be.
Yeah.
That's the main distinction.
Good sci-fi. Yeah.
So I've seen some people, for instance, the game takes place in a future where, everything is taken care of by machines and AIs. So, you know, there is just no way to work as a human. We are basically worthless now in production. Maybe it's a good thing, you know. I mean, before, you know, we used to be like humans, right? We've known the era of survival. First, we were hunter-gatherers, and then we started to domesticate nature, you know, through hunting and farming. Farming.
Yeah, agrarian lifestyle.
Yeah, all of that. And we are still, so hero of survival, and then hero of work, basically, production, you know, waking up every day, doing your job, and at the end, you have a predictable outcome.
Yeah.
And we are still in that era. We still have to wake up and, you know, create value to get access to a roof, right? But the thing is, maybe we're not very far from an era where basically we don't need to work anymore. Mm-hmm. And so what kind of society is it, you know, like I don't see a lot of pieces tackling that in a certain way. And we're trying to paint a world where basically, you know, you as a human, you're not the ultimate alpha and omega on Earth. You're not the smartest thing. Mm. You know, it's going to be our next great wound as humans, you know, like we had a lot like that. Like we were not the center of universe. You know, the sun doesn't revolve around the Earth, and we just evolved from apes and all of that.
It's not flat too, people. Man, what's going on with the whole flat thing, man? Stop it, people.
So,
seriously, I just flew around the Earth just the other day. I came back from Europe. I literally felt it's a globe. You guys got to get in a plane and fly around it. Trust me, it's not flat. Come on, guys. Kidding me.
Come on. Yeah,
so that shit blows me away. I can't believe people are saying that the Earth is flat. I'm like, dude, and it's 8,000 years old or something like that. I mean, come on, guys. Gotta stop that.
Come on.
It's tripping me up. Yeah, let's keep moving forward. Let's evolve. But sorry, I love the idea that you're saying, though. That's really cool because it's very complex, right? And I think there one thing I want to say in this, and when you're talking about your theme and stuff, is there is something to be said, and maybe it comes from my old habitual nature of growing up without all these distractions, is that when you earn like a really hard day's worth of work, let's say you go out and do some manual labor or you achieve something really great, there's this feeling of worth, and I don't know if it's pride.
Exactly.
I don't know what it is, but your food tastes better. You can sleep better. Everything in my body and my mind is at peace.
Is enhanced, yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's something interesting there. And I don't know, I guess you probably talk about tying that into your story, but I didn't mean to interrupt.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. The thing is, we all define ourselves by what we create or what we do right now, right? Like you will define yourself as a director or, you know, a motion designer or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you will define himself as a writer and people, you know, as journalists. So yeah, what happens if you remove work?
Yeah.
How do you define yourself as a human? Mm-hmm. Who are you really? Not as a guy who do something, but who are you? That's a question. Like, do you define yourself by your taste, by what you watch, but by what you listen? You know.
Humans will always need a cultural currency.
Yeah.
At the moment, in the past, it was survival.
Yeah.
And food, and then, as you said, like it became wealth.
Yeah.
Like literal currency now. Obviously, wealth is still an issue, but it's much more about that.
Oh, we already see the transition. Like it's less and less about money and more about attention.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Like
cultural capital.
And... Yeah, because right now people are not lacking money to have fun. They're lacking time, right?
Yeah.
So we are not competing for money with other game developers. We are competing for attention.
Yeah.
and I think it's going to be the currency of the future, basically. Yeah. It's like the more followers and you know, the more you have a mediatic capital, the more you're worth, basically, in the future. So it's something interesting. You know, until now, capital was mostly cultural in a family, you know, cultural and financial. But I think there is a new capital, you know, that only
the new rich
rock stars. Yeah. Only rock stars did that before, you know, like when you're the kid, like the son of a big rock star, you know, automatically you inherit some of its fame, right?
Yeah.
Like the son of David Bowie, you know, is making the Warcraft movie.
Yeah. Moon so and stuff.
He made Moon and everything. So, and not to remove anything from, not to say he doesn't deserve it or he didn't work hard to get there. What I mean is that, you know, there is this, this other capital now, which is like the mediatic one.
Exactly. You could say that Duncan Jones was, some people are born into money.
Yeah.
Obviously David Bowie made money, but like born into that kind of family, that's it's a mindset. It's a perspective. It's, I love Duncan Jones.
It's very simple. You know, even you in the future, if you have like 100,000 followers, it will be so much easier to launch your children into life.
Yeah.
Because any project they start or anything, they already have this big, you know, reach suddenly. And it's not the same as from someone from a family that is not that much into internet, for instance,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So I guess it's even the case for you, Ash. Like you have 20,000 followers and I guess much more on Instagram and everything. So if one day you have a daughter, you know, that start to sing or something, it's going to be like you have a head start, basically.
If you choose to use it that way, you can bring that force to bear.
Yeah.
On.
And today it's even more, this is more important, I feel, than money in a certain way. It's starting to be more important. And that's where the game takes place. Mm. The game takes place in a world where money is removed from equation because there is no work.
Yeah.
So you have universal income. And you know, so I've seen people saying that, that we are critical of universal income and we're like trying to make a capitalist game and everything.
People are saying that on social media and they're jumping to conclusions on what you're saying, what you're doing as a game.
I mean, this is,
do you want to give them a blanket statement response to them so that when they hear this, they can quiet down or you don't?
Well, my response would be, like, first of all, when people are saying it, you know, my initial reaction is like, I'm amazed that they care so much.
Yeah, true.
in a good way. Like, yeah, awesome. I love that. Sorry?
I said, it's awesome that they're, I mean, good or bad, they're reacting and interacting. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I love that these people are so passionate about cyberpunk and effectively about our game, even if they're negatively passionate in the moment.
It still makes them think,
It still makes you think, and they're interacting. And all I ever had the impulse to be able to say to them was like, just as I said to one person on Twitter who was kind of subtweeting, but fairly rationally, I was like, just you know, like George Orwell with 1984, he didn't want that to become the future.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's almost a precursor, like a cautionary tale, kind of like an Aesop fable or something. Same with Charlie Newman with Black Mirror. He's kind of like, hey, you know, be careful. You know, we're going down this path. Please be cautious, you know.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to do the Gattaca, as a Black Mirror video games. Yeah. You know, we're trying to make something that is not, it doesn't have to be a horrible warning. It's more like this is what the future could be, you know, if we exaggerate some aspect of it. And, you know, some people are going to love it and some people are going to hate it. And that's normal. Even people in the game, I mean, like citizens of the city, some of them are going to enjoy, you know, having free time to take care of their children in the morning and everything.
Yeah.
But some people, maybe some creative people, you know, like how can you have any desire or strive to write? Because it will be drawn instantly into the billions of generated stories on the fly by AI. So how can you think that you can came up with everything interesting?
I mean, people suffer with that now, right?
Already.
But it's like you just reminded me, you know, the opening to The Big Lebowski, which is obviously not a cyberpunk film.
Oh, what? Well, I thought it was cyberpunk, man.
You've been living
that bowling pin thing was pretty sci-fi feeling. So, no, I'm just joking. Yeah, I love that movie.
What reading of it is that Lebowski was actually a clone.
He was.
Of Lebowski.
Yeah, he was Roy Batty's uncle. So
yeah, but you know, they say at the beginning, Sam Elliott's character says, you know, in every time there is somebody that is just so perfect that time, and it's the dude. Is just, he is the man for that time, you know, slapping around, drinking his milk through his beard. There will always be people that thrive in the time, and there will always be people that feel like they belong to another time, and that's just part of the human condition, and it kind of sucks, unfortunately. If you're one of the people that feels like you belong in, I don't know, dark ages of Britain, and you want to be running around swinging a mace and getting scurvy,
I guess if you're a bit violent or anything, like, you know, maybe middle age was a better. Maybe middle age was like a better time for you. But like right now, we are more in an era where
we're in a great era too. Not for everybody, it's true. There are some people that don't want to live in this area, or they don't. You know, they have to deal with these like social norms of dealing with like political correctness and all that crap getting in the way of them wanting to just be themselves, even if they are crass and an asshole, you know, like they want to be able to be themselves, and they probably would have fit better in like the 50s or whatever, you know.
They probably would have been. I mean, but that, and that is the difficulty of the human condition. And then that's all we're trying to, you know, show in the game is like, you know, anybody listening that thinks that we hate universal basic income and that we want this kind of weird fascist future, you know, we don't want it. We might show an aspect of it to explore ideas.
Flirting
but
with
it's,
it.
It's not, it's not because we want it to be that way.
But you're flirting with the ideas, and I think that's for me, my standpoint on sci-fi, and I think I forget the author's name. The guy, he wrote this short story that was then adapted into this film called Arrival. Have you seen Arrival?
Oh
no,
that was Denny's other film. So
I know who you mean. Yeah, he's a short story writer, mm-hmm. and he's not. He's really, really shy, isn't he? He kind of.
Yeah.
He was like a technical writer or like a scientist or something, and he kind of
he's very scientific.
What's his name?
The original story is called Story of Your Life, and it was written by Ted Chiang.
Chiang,
And he I bought the Arrival, and I got the behind the scenes because I love all that stuff too, because I'm very interested in the process of making things, obviously. That's what the Collective Podcast is. And he said was really interesting. He was talking about his articulation on the creating these worlds and the deal of how he was having to work with like I lost my train of thought trying to figure out this thing. What were we talking about? Sorry, because I was like Googling as I was doing this.
About Arrival and what he wanted to say about, you know, how he created the world in Arrival.
Total, my brain just died. I'm in the wrong era right now. Source stories, okay. Doug King.
Yeah. I can bounce back on Universal Com if you want.
I'm sure. No, I don't edit these too, so I just sound like a complete idiot for the future, for forever on the internet. I think that's fine. I mean, there was something that was interesting about the way he was creating that, though. Damn, I forgot it. It'll probably come back eventually. So, but it was a really interesting behind the scenes. I think you'd really enjoy it because his whole process on creating the story of your life was. Okay, I got it. It's back. Okay, the thread of thought came back. He was talking about sci-fi to him, and when he said it was so articulate. He really, I think, it resonated. I'm going to butcher it now, but he was saying that like great sci-fi to him isn't about like you know a good versus evil or you know bullets and guns and a wardrobe or something. It's about telling a possible outcome or a cautionary tale or some sort of like augmentation of a possible outcome. And he using that as a device. And for him, when he made Arrival, he really liked the idea of thinking about a part inside of sci-fi films that often gets overlooked is what if an alien came, but we had to learn how to communicate with him. And then that whole concept, the whole film became about what is communication and how communication done through time is very unique and very dynamic. And I really enjoyed the film personally, and it kind of tied in with a lot of films I like personally, but it got you thinking and feeling the emotion more. And I thought that was really cool. Yeah. And it's sci-fi it's really done well, I think so.
The kind of art we need to create right now because
I agree.
You know, there is more and more divide in society everywhere. I feel especially in the US, you know, you grow up with superheroes and pop culture and a very Manichaean binary pop culture, you know, with bad versus evil, good versus evil all the time. Yeah. You know, you have orcs versus humans, you know, you have Sith versus Jedi. And you know, it's too easy, right? It's like the bad guys are always ugly or red, you know, they're color coded basically. And it's always easily identifiable. But of course, the real world is so much more complex, you know,
there really Danny is no good or evil, really. It's just different perspectives, isn't it?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, everybody thinks they're the hero of their own story.
Yeah. Serial killer, I mean, is probably like, this is just natural. This is what I do, you know?
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, what some people may see as an ideal way, you know, to get to some ideals. It might be a complete nightmare for someone else, actually. We can share ideals sometimes, you know, and still completely disagree on the way to get there. For instance, you know, if you take communism, it's not uninteresting, right? Like, you know, sharing and everything. Why not? Like, it's much more complex than that, but I don't have the time to develop. But yeah, what I mean by that is what's horrible usually is implementation of communism, you know, that led to the death to so many millions of people. So, and I feel that, you know, this polarization of any ideological, you know, debate, you know, is really dangerous. And you know, I mean, internet is fascinating for that. I've put a quote from someone called Ben Thompson, who's a technology analyst, and he said something like that. He said that, you know, internet is on par with industrial revolution in terms of impact. And, you know, industrial revolution was great, right? Like it moved millions of people out of poverty. And, you know, it made all of us much richer. I know with like a lot less, you know, shortage of food and everything. So yeah, great. But at the same time, industrialization enabled these new democracies and the new systems, you know, and it enables the two great wars, the two world wars, right? So he thinks in a certain way that internet might be kind of the same, you know, in terms of impact. And I can certainly see that, you know, like internet, when it was like the far west at the beginning, you know, it was very libertarian and everything. And now the more we're progressing, the more we try people, you know, trying to take on the internet and try to, you know, control it in a certain way. Whether it's conservative or progressive, you know, both sides of the coin, as usual, you know, try to get some control over it. And what's interesting in that for me is trenches. People are getting entrenched, basically. You know, they use labels and then, you know, you get in a trench and you never move out. And what happens is that, you know, the deeper you're in your trench, the more you're stuck in your echo chamber. You only see things from your personal bias, your personal lens, right? And that's a real problem. I don't know if you've seen also, there was a great web page showing two Facebook feeds during the American elections. Yeah. One of them was a Democratic leaning person, and yeah. the other one was like a Republican leaning person. And it's crazy because they cover the same news, the exact same news.
Yeah.
In two completely different ways. Yeah. One of them was like, you know, I don't know, you know, it's like, there is always a way to see something.
It would be like
to your advantage.
I think one of them was like a Trump rally, right? Where it was just exactly the same rally.
Yeah.
But the way that someone had taken one photo made it look like there weren't many people there. And then the way that the Republican had taken it made it look like there were lots of people there.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like,
perspective.
Yeah. And that's
your perception, though, you know.
And so how
that's like your perception, man.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Let's get meta. Let's do it.
The thing is, how do you filter the truth? You know, like there is so much noise now. How do you know what is true?
And maybe it's a big problem. It's a big problem.
It's a big problem, right? And Kojima, I don't know if you're familiar with Kojima's work. You know, in Metal Gear Solid 2, but he was really prescient about that. Because at the end of the game, you basically realize that the Patriots, you know, the kind of hidden group.
The Illuminati.
Yeah, illuminating thing, you know, is actually a group of AI that are managing. And yeah, they're managing internet, and especially they are like clearing internet because they say that, you know, it's very simple. Your DNA, right? There is some kind of selection through time, right? Like the bad genes, you know, are getting, basically you die if you have bad genes and you survive if you have genes that favor your survival, okay? And the same thing happened with art until now, or, you know, everything like writing, painting, whatever. Like history was an incredible filter for art. Like it only kept the best pieces, basically. But right now we have internet, and internet saves everything all the time. Including the most, you know, mundane stuff and the most wrong stuff.
Yeah.
And so how do you, like, it basically we are like polluting, you know, like human, this is a giant human archive in a certain way. And we need to start to maybe, you know, start like an evolution process through it. You know, we need to start to filter out what happened through time and to only keep, what was true, I don't know, but I feel
so
right
hard
now
to tell, right? Because truth is in the eye of the beholder, same as subjectivity is with art, you know, which is so interesting.
Yeah.
I watched an interesting documentary called My Kid Could Paint That. Have you seen that?
No.
Oh, what's that? Super good. It's basically about this documentary. I won't get too far into it because it does have some twists I don't want to ruin for you. But the overall arching thing is about this 4-year-old girl who starts doing these paintings, and their parents like just sell them like at a casual like coffee shop just for fun because one of their friends like runs it. And then she became like this huge phenom across the world. And it was a big question of what art is, what modern art is. And she like, she was selling paintings, and she ended up making like $300,000 or something like that for like her first show. She's 4 years old, you know? And so it's really interesting.
Have you seen the paintings, Ash, made by the bear in Iceland?
No, there's a bear doing paintings. That's awesome.
Yeah. It's like a grizzly bear in some zoo in Iceland, and they discovered that it liked to paint, and it recently had its first exhibition of, I'm not kidding. It's like 10 really beautiful abstract paintings done by this grizzly bear. And it's like, same principle as this with the 4-year-old.
I know, but you know, all of that for me, you can encompass all of that into what we call, you know, postmodernism, which is, you know, a view where everything is
valid.
Is valid and everything is equal in a certain way.
Yeah.
And which I personally disagree with, because then, you know, if there is no ugliness, there is no beauty, you know, in a certain way. Like you need to have a kind of a scale of things to, right? Like I'm not a big fan of modern art, to be honest. I guess also that's why I prefer the very detailed and gritty world we can see in Blade Runner 1, you know, compared to Blade Runner 2, that is a much more clear picture, but for me, much more like modern art, you know, it's more trying to express its themes maybe through, you know, a way, a use of light, you know, rather than using the proper set piece, for instance, of the background. So anyway, so yeah, I mean, it's a complex topic, but yeah, all of that comes down to,
We should watch that documentary. You'll like it.
Yeah, it sounds great. Yeah. I'll definitely.
Just throw you for a loop. You'll see. And there's it's more than just that. And if you're listening to this, you haven't watched that, I highly recommend it, especially if you're into art, film, being creative in any kind of capacity in this kind of world and dealing with like publicity and marketing and all that stuff. I mean, a lot of it just touches on all of these really interesting things that are quite scary.
The thing is, you know, it's like I sometimes feel like we and this is a function of postmodernism, that like we live in such an overwhelmingly complex environment that, you know, postmodernism said, and this is why it says it, that everything is valid, because how can you possibly make sense of the world we live in compared to what it was like 200, 300 years ago? But on the other hand, if you reduce everything to that and to just say, to not be rigorous and to just say, yes, everything is valid, everything is acceptable, then of course nothing you muddy the waters.
Yeah,
so the ending monologue in Metal Gear Solid 2, and I guess like we're trying to do in the game, but I think almost like we should all try and do is just drill down to what our tastes are. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, I want the Icelandic bear to have the right to paint.
Sure. But well, who cares? But, what does it affect you? You know, it's like, that's my funny thing. It's like why people get so like their freaking underwear in a twist. It's like, who gives a fucking shit? Let the bear paint, you know? Like, and who does that affect your life? Why don't you just focus on what you want to do? You know, what makes you happy? Yeah.
I think it's important. I think the most important thing is that we all reserve the right to be incredibly judgmental. Basically, we should all take the responsibility to really, really be quite
prejudiced. It's about the value of doubt, basically. Like people are so full of certainty, especially on Twitter, basically.
Yeah. I'm thinking about quitting Twitter because it's just so annoying. It's such a bunch of noise. I'm just like, ah, and it's a lot of attention whores on there. I'm just like, fuck off, man. Like, I just feel like it's doing more damage to me than any good. And I'm like, but I think there's something about it when you go through something that you don't like, it's important to analyze why. And so I'm kind of, that's the only reason I'm holding on to it. Cause I'm like, why do I hate this now? You know, like, why is this not a fun thing anymore? And I think a lot of it's coming down to just the people that congregate on there. It's a really horrible, you take something as dynamic and beautiful as a language, for example, and you take one what's like, let's say the ultimate prime example of great communication is almost the silent communication that you have with another physical person right in front of you. Okay. Oh, let's add complexity of, let's say, let's add some words basically to that. Okay. And then now let's remove that. Let's go on the internet now. Okay. Let's do that. Let's make that like, you know, the way we do it. Oh, let's remove your ability to be concise and articulate. Let's only say you can like say 5 words. Good luck. Yeah. You know, and for me, I just look at it and go, this is a ticking time bomb for the biggest clusterfuck ever existent. And I think that's what it is. And I'm like, kind of like, it's like a social organism that I'm kind of like, it doesn't work. You take something as complex and unique and special, and then you just kind of strip it to its core and ruin its actual core.
Twitter is absolutely like the ultimate example of regression to the mean, right? It's like,
I'm quoting you on that one. That's great.
It started, you know, obviously like it started in such a way and it was very interesting and new. It was inevitable that over time it would just become slush.
The problem is, you know, like it was never supposed to be a platform to discuss politics or anything. It's supposed to be sharing links and inspiration, you know, and stuff like that. And now, you know, elections are depending on Twitter.
Yeah.
And for me, that's completely insane, you know.
Yeah.
And when I see, I don't know if you've seen this absurd movie called Idiocracy, you know.
Idiocracy? Yeah. Yeah. That's America right now. Yeah.
Exactly. And today, did you see Trump, you know, like with the GIF, you know, he put a GIF of himself, you know, catching CNN. And I'm like, this is rock bottom of society. Like, we it's completely insane. Yeah. And
the irony is that some people see him and his perspective on life and the world and everything that he's doing as being the good thing, you know, and that's what's really interesting. And I never really thought of him and that whole thing until I often listen to Joe Rogan's podcast. Have you guys listened to his podcast? It's really interesting.
Yeah, it's quite good. Yeah.
And he had, I think it was a 9/11 podcast, and he had this guy on there that runs fake news, I think it's called.com. I don't pay attention to news. Yeah. I don't watch news. I don't care about that stuff really. And people go, how could you be like that? I'm like, it's too much noise. But it was really interesting because this guy was like a full conspiracy theorist, and he seemed to be well educated, and he had all this like knowledge of all these people, and he was talking like he had some legitimate interesting things. And then he is a big Trump supporter. And I was like, wow, that's so interesting. What if it is a Kojima thing where Trump is actually good and the media is destroying him and twisting this? And I was thinking to myself, you know, I think it's really important. And I think it's always important, no matter what you are doing in life, is to stop analytically, if you can, have question authority and think for yourself, like the Timothy Leary expression or the quote that he says. I think it's really important, no matter what, is you should question what you're dealing with and what you're experiencing, because it's very important, because you never know who's being honest and not. And at the same time, like, how much does it affect you too, and being aware of that?
Exactly.
And is it important? Is it good enough for you to ruin your day because Trump has a gift Twitter, and then you're just like, you know, and you barf all kinds of stupid shit on the internet that always lives and stamps you forever. So, yeah.
Amen to that. Like, for me, that's what it all boils down to is, you know, human language is imprecise. It's impossible to ever know exactly how somebody else is feeling. And you've got to make a choice, like, every day, which is, am I going to let all this uncertainty and complete unknowable ambiguity get me down? Like, or am I just going to try and do the stuff that makes me happy and hopefully makes the people around me happy? And
that's a smart way. Like, we have little worlds, right? And the world's separated by 5 degrees, I think, of whatever it is. It's like, and so I have my whole thought on this is that if you affect somebody in the world around you in a very positive nature, and I try to do this with the podcast, you know, like bring people like yourself, awesome individuals that are doing great things and inspiring others and stuff. I bring you guys on here and talk about that. I'm widening my world, but the world that is very close to me, my wife, my daughter, my very close friends, my small pocket of, like, I don't know, 30, 40 individuals, I try to give the most positive and the greatest experience with them, because I know that if I'm giving that to them in a healthy way, that they will hopefully take that and give that out to their own worlds. And then those worlds definitely spread, you know, and hopefully it influences other people, so that the world itself, if through one good action, I think, hopefully turns into another, you know. But I mean, the world isn't all about just being, you know, happy and everything like that, but it can be great. It's just a matter of your perception, I think, which is really key.
I mean, we live in the best era ever.
I think so. I'm stoked to be here. I wish I could live longer, but I'm happy to be here. So I need that CRISPR, that CRISPR
too
stuff.
Soon.
So,
never know.
No, but
give it 5 years.
You know, the world has never been as safe as today, and as you know, as interesting. And I mean, you know, before you, when you were born, you know, you knew you were going to make the same job for all your life, basically.
Yeah.
And now we have such exciting life. You know, like every 5 years, it's changing so much. You have no idea where you're going to be in 10 years. Yeah. You know. Yeah. And this is a fascinating prospect, and it's very stimulating, I feel, you know.
Yeah. And so, I think I completely agree with both of you, and I think it's ultimately liberating. You know, a lot of people of our generation, and I've gone through this, I'm sure both of you have at some point, suffer from, you know, real anxiety about our place in the world because we've got so much opportunity.
Yeah.
But once you learn that, if anything, the most strong responsibility we have, given our privilege, our relative privilege, and that applies to everybody, whatever your privilege is, the biggest responsibility you have is to make the most of that. You know, it would be the most criminal thing would be to waste the privilege that you do have. Yeah, so use it. You use it to do something good and helpful. Don't throw away your privilege. Use it. You know, use it somehow. Use what you have. And like you said, like you, Ash, you do it with your art. You know, I found you on Instagram, and that inspires me on a day to day basis. And now here we are on a podcast, and hopefully something that we've all said will inspire someone else. And that makes you happy. Me happy.
I received the best. Yeah. Email, one of the best email of my life. Like when I was 3 years old, you know, no, 4 years old, sorry, I received
Sega Genesis. I'm joking.
No, I received a Sega Genesis at home, and instead of being obsessed by Sonic or Mario, I received Flashback. And I was completely blown away by this game, you know, which it had such smooth animations. And it was for me, it was, you know, more like a visual novel than a game in a certain way. You know, it made me experience something. Anyway, so that was my favorite game back then. And recently, you know, after the trailer, I received an email from the original artist.
Oh, wow.
Flashback, yeah. And he told me that, you know, it was one of the most beautiful day of his life, basically, you know, to see that 25 years later, you know, a kid, you know, that grew up with his work, basically, you know, is kind of taking up the legacy, you know, like to see the impact he had in the world. It was fascinating for him.
Wow.
And he was so, he basically told me, I can die now.
And, that is so cool.
Yeah, it's crazy cool. And I was like, you know, maybe in 25 years, you know, a kid will grow up playing The Last Night and will be like, wow.
yeah, you never know, right? That's beautiful. I mean,
it would be stupid to not use, you know, it would be stupid with the skill set we have to not use it to create something. Mm-hmm. Like we could continue to sell glasses and, you know, to make advertisement, but we all chose to create world instead. And I feel it's the best thing we can do right now.
So silly. That people are doing that, you know. Often it was kind of interesting. I just got back from Europe too, and man, the amount of churches I mean, I'm not religious, I'm not atheist, I'm not really any of those things. I just kind of, there's definitely got to be something beyond us, obviously, but I don't know what it is. It's too complex for me to even think about. So I kind of just go through life as a dumb mere mortal. But I was really, it was like taken back. I was like, wow, this is the biggest institution in Europe and in America too. It's like the God Institution in all different forms. It's really interesting because every big, large building is devoted to a belief system, you know? And I thought that was really interesting. I'm going on a tangent here, but it was, I think, you know, talking about wars and stuff, but I think, what a waste. And I always say that, you know, the best gift you ever give in your life is going to be your mind and consciousness. And that's given to you for free at birth. You're basically given like ultimate potential right when you start. And what a damn waste you just spend, you know, just doing nothing or wasting your time. That's like, it always blows me away. And I always think, like, you know, out of all the things we could do, it's like, man, use that time that you have. Because the thing is, time is fleeting, you know, and use that time to do something cool and hopefully not be a jerk and do great things for people that, you know, even if it's like, you guys aren't trying to solve cancer or world hunger, but you're trying to make something entertaining for people that might want to have a nice distraction away from like a reality they don't like and get them inspired to go do their own thing, you know? And that itself is enough, you know, to open up a possibility to a better life for somebody. I feel like we've gone so far to the left and the right on this. And I feel so bad for people that are probably listening to this going like, well, where's the video game talk? Because we talked a little bit about it. I have a couple questions that I kind of gathered throughout them because I asked the internet for people that had any questions. So I know we're running out of time here, but getting into some of those questions is what limitations when creating The Last Night, be it artistry, gameplay, or otherwise, had led to the most intuitive solutions? So did you have anything that were really difficult that you guys found cool solutions to get over and find ways of making those things possible? And what were those?
Yeah, well, the main one would be replacing the vertical gameplay by depth. So I'm going to explain why. You know, in 2D games, basically like Oddworld, Flashback, Another World, Prince of Persia, you were jumping on platforms vertically, you know, so X and Y axis. And, you know, I think in our current life, in like urban life, you don't jump a lot around. you don't really move like that. So I thought, okay, let's make a more realistic experience, you know, where you're mostly walking around instead of jumping. But quickly, you know, I faced a problem that we were only going left or right. And it was a bit boring, you know. So what we found out, you know, is that we decided to be like, okay, let's replace the y-axis, you know, the vertical axis, by the depth, by the z-axis. So instead of having a xy game, we have a xz game, you know, where we can move around in 3D into the space. So let me explain. You can, when you move with your pad, you know, you go left or right. But what happens is that the path, the character is taking, is actually a 3D path, which means that you can turn around corners. You know, you can, you can enter someone's place, you know, and then if you're stuck because the police is outside, you can jump by the balcony and end up somewhere else, you know, into the city. Mm. Because everything is properly laid down in 3D, you know, it's not just going left or right, it's like a proper 3D world in a certain way. Yeah. So even if you experience it on a 2D way, on a 2D plane, you know, you still navigate around a 3D world. So that was an interesting solution to the constraints here.
Hmm. That's interesting. And dealing with that too. Another thing we didn't really get into is just kind of like I love it. You guys your minds are so just on a really interesting level. And the one thing is that for most people that I've met and interacted with that have that kind of mind that you guys have, that abstract, you know, very cognitive and like very aware of certain things, most of those people, they don't do much because they're constantly in the ether of like, yeah, you know, like, yeah. Wow. How, because making a game is very difficult. You yes. must have yeah. discipline. So how the hell did you do both of those things together is basically next question. That's a selfish question for me because it's something I encounter a lot with artists. Most artists are yeah. too hard on themselves, so they're procrastinators. But how did you manage to do this? And what's kind of like some daily habits or things that you've done that have helped you make a game basically or build things out so that you can have something to show at the end of the day?
Fear.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. You know, if you like, I'm definitely a procrastinator, but procrastination is good. Without procrastinating, I wouldn't have a tenth of all the ideas we have, you know, for this game.
Does it give you room to breathe and think? Is that what
yeah,
it is?
Okay. It's a part of the process, actually. Like it doesn't exist a creative process where you just churn out content all the time. It doesn't exist. You have to accept that some days you're going to be slacking off and you're going to be lost and you're going to go back to certain things and you're going to, sometimes you feel you're going in circles.
Yeah.
But you know, all these times while you're preparing, there is one moment where everything connects, where suddenly you know exactly what to do. You have the right team, you have the right persons, you have the right goals, the right deadline. Everything is correct, and bam, you can spend 3 months, no question asked. You just nail it.
Yeah.
And you do in 3 months what other people could do in 1 year. So it's always, you know, a balance like that. Like, it would be nice to be more stable and predictable, but you know, in a way, I kind of like the freeform aspect of creation. You know, like we have to respect this process because that's where you get art, right? If you make it like a production line for making a car, then you end up with a product. You don't end up with art, basically. Mm. So the fact that the game is so unique is because I had the time to let my mind, you know, play with stuff. I spent a year playing in Unity around, just trying stuff and concepts and trying where it would get me. Mm. And that's how we came up with all of that, basically.
Mm. So what do you do while you're doing this, too? Because, like, this is obviously an off-hours thing. So are you designing and doing motion graphics for companies and clients while this is happening?
Yes. I was juggling between freelance work, you know, for, yeah.
It's advertising, difficult to do that, you know. Right? Do you have a hard time with that balance?
Yeah, so that was in the past.
Yeah, it was in the past, yeah.
Previously, okay. Yeah, we're all full-time, or the majority of us are full-time in the game now.
And it's funded by a private investor, or is this something that you guys have managed to put together?
We have a publisher.
Oh, okay.
We
have a publisher. Awesome.
So, but the thing is, when Tim talks about procrastination, it's, you know, it's procrast creation, to use a silly term, because, you know, Tim's version of procrastination might be creating an amazing lighting shader in Unity, okay. Where technically he's procrastinating from doing some level design, but he's procrastinating by, you know, learning a crazy kind of new plugin in Unity. Awesome. So
I'm the same way. That's good.
Yeah, but that's actually a really good piece of advice in general, because Tim and I work in very different ways, and also we have different jobs. So we're very different in a lot of ways, but I think that's a good piece of advice that applies to anybody, is like if you're struggling to do your specific kind of task, whatever either you've told yourself you need to do or someone's told you to do, like, don't force it, but don't just do nothing. Just do something else.
Just embrace it, you know, like you don't want to work on it, it's fine, but do something productive, like watch, buy a tutorial on Gumroad and watch someone doing digital painting. I don't know why, but maybe one day it will be helpful to you. Like, you know, if I didn't spend all this time watching SciGraph videos back then and, you know, watching technical papers, like I wouldn't have been able to create a studio 5 years later.
Yeah,
that's a good and point. People thought I was procrastinating as a motion designer before, you know, like why the fuck are you watching all these real time papers? And now I'm like, you know, yeah, maybe you guys, right. It's time for you motion designers to come to real time now.
Yeah. The thing that's helped me the most is like, having that outlet, because right when, and I think this is really universal, when you're feeling a bit stuck, it's very, very natural to want to run away, right? This is the timeless writer's dilemma, is the fear of the empty page. And the biggest thing that's helped me is like, I pretty much just have a couple of tabs open now with like useful either writing advice, or there's a couple of blogs, Brain Pickings by Maria Popova, Farnham Street by Shane Parrish, which are blogs about thinking and creativity. So when I have that urge to run away from my task, I just read, and it's still technically not what I'm supposed to be doing, but it's actually still very inspiring and positive and useful.
Yeah.
And you know, and then it's hard to feel very kind of guilty for reading something inspiring and positive.
Yeah.
it's towards the same trajectory, I think, was what you're getting at, and I think that's a brilliant way to look at it. And I didn't realize I do the same exact thing. And sometimes I feel bad because I'm like, oh, I should be learning, because I'm working on a game too. So I'm like, I should really be learning Substance. But then I go into it, I'm like, I don't want to learn this right now. So then I go and do something else. But the thing is, even if I go and sit and watch a movie or something, I'm constantly thinking about it.
Yes.
Those things, I think, I've been having a big thought about this whole procrastinating thing and why, like, I have hard time sometimes finishing certain things, and I feel like I'm pretty disciplined, and I find like my students or other people have a difficulty finishing things. And I think a lot of it just comes from, like you mentioned it earlier, Tim, like there's just like those perfect moments, you know, things where like everything aligns. The thing with life is that it doesn't always like that, you know, like the project might not be exactly you might get a project too early in your life where it changes you. Like I've seen a lot of film directors, their career get ruined because they had the big opportunity too early and they weren't able to execute it because they didn't have that understanding of what it was they're doing and any of those things, you know. And I think what I'm getting at is timing is really important, but I don't think using that as an example of an excuse to not make action is key. Yeah. I think what you guys are saying is really, that's brilliant advice, I think, because if you hit a wall, I think it's important to constantly keep moving, but at the same time being aware that you are moving towards a trajectory that is eventually leading to a similar goal. I want to be creative. Yes, so then you're just going to be creative in some way, which I think is awesome.
Exactly.
This is awesome. You guys are awesome. We have to do another one of these. I'm sorry, because we'd only have so much time. I would love to have you guys back on. I want to talk more about the details of, like, you know, building these games and all that stuff too. But I love, and I hope for everybody that's listening to this and people that might have had questions about what you guys are up to and all that stuff, are some of their things are silenced or they're more intrigued or whatever it is, because this is a better, more dynamic platform than like a Twitter post or something, obviously.
Exactly.
I'd love for you guys to come on at any time you guys want to, if you guys have more releases or whatever, and we can talk more about, you know, your experience of building these things and designing and creating these worlds and building games, because this is really interesting. I'm really excited for you guys, and I'm curious to see where this all goes. And I'm hoping everybody's enjoying this conversation. And I usually like to end the episode with that advice. You're welcome. But I think you guys I was going to ask you, like, what would you give as advice to somebody that wants to make games? But you guys kind of just nailed it at the end naturally. So, yeah, and we're good to go, man. I really appreciate you guys being on the show. And thank you guys so much for the time. And to everybody out there that's listening, I hope you guys enjoyed it. And that concludes this week's episode. Big thank yous to Tim and Danny for coming on the show and sharing their time with us this week. You can find links to the show notes for this week's episode at thecollectivepodcast.com/159, along with links to our Facebook, Twitter, and iTunes podcast page. Have an amazing day, everybody. Be powerful, be prolific, peace out.